Welcome to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On the Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER FM nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program,
a one-page business plan. Let's get our first sale. So once you've got a sale, you've actually proved you've got a valid business idea.
Got a side hustle that you think you can make money out of? What do you need to take control of your career, utilise your talents and spin them off into a lucrative business? We'll find out. Also on the show,
when you are handling other people's data, that you are liable for securing their contents as well.
Computer hacking can mean that if your computer is compromised, you can be responsible for people whom you have dealt with or other businesses that you have information on. We look at the latest issues in cybersecurity. Stay tuned. We have all this and more coming up on the Money. But first, small businesses face many concerns nowadays, but one question that they may ask themselves is how do they deal with foreign exchange? In an increasingly globalised world, even these small companies are reliant on suppliers and trade from international sources. With the plethora of free trade deals done by our government and globalisation, access to overseas suppliers is increasingly crucial for small businesses. Ryan Stanton spoke with John Donaghy, Business Development Manager at Octet, to find out more about how this climate is changing.
Well, I suppose that when we look at, as you said, rightly said there, the businesses are trying to become more global, and I guess the pressures which do apply with a number of these businesses are one in terms of, I guess, breaking the norm and looking at actually trusting those suppliers and finding trusted suppliers overseas. And one of the big risks, or I suppose, or issues that that Australian buyers face is one, the validity of actually these suppliers in the first place, and then issues with regards to language barriers as well, and then also when they actually come to funding, and actually funding these transactions on a supply chain process as well, that also creates those uncertainties for Australian buyers. So when looking at bringing in goods from, say, China, as an example, which is Australia's number one trading partner there, knowing the right process to go through in terms of how the payment structure works, how what percentage of deposit is needed to be paid, and then that all ties into foreign exchange as well, which currency is going to be transferred and then factoring in that foreign exchange rate. So there's definitely a lot of moving parts when it comes to Australian businesses and finding new suppliers overseas.
I imagine the moving parts make it quite difficult. Is that part of why you think there is sort of a deficit in trust in these areas?
Yeah, absolutely. And businesses as well, as rightly so, are often very much risk averse. But the way that trade is now, and the cost of manufacturing in Australia is far too high. So branching out and being able to procure goods from overseas, in particular China, is a necessary step for businesses to grow. But you're right in saying that those moving parts, it's not just as simple as the communication and sourcing goods from factories in China. It's the whole supply chain from start to finish.
Yeah, so that's one of the things I do want to cover, because Australian businesses are often risk averse. Does it make it difficult for businesses when they try to keep control of their costs, but the Aussie dollar can fluctuate substantially from when they place an order to payment and shipment times?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the way that the Aussie dollar has been tracking, I mean, I was just having a look earlier. I mean, in the last two years, the Aussie-US has dropped 18%. And if businesses haven't factored into that exchange rate with regards to taking out certain hedging products to protect them along the way, and if they have any predictability on that, on those purchases, an 18% hit off the bottom line of any business, no matter how big or small, is going to have a huge effect. And even looking at the start of this year, from January 1, we were at 70.47 Aussie USD. We're now at 66.47. So that 4-cent drop already this year, and that continued pressure on the Aussie dollar, from internal and external factors, is always going to play a big effect on businesses, and it's something which a lot of companies don't take into effect, and it's only an issue when finally the number on the page gets big enough to notice, but certainly it's something which always should be tracked and appropriately managed.
So how can businesses take this into effect and work to reduce the risk inherent in dealing with these foreign currencies?
So there's a few ways. One is when it comes down to the actual predictability of the rate. Well, I guess no one really can predict which way rates are going to go. I mean, I've seen chief economists get it wrong consistently. So the ways to really protect and, or guess, mitigate that risk for the business are to assess what are the budget rates of that business.
Is there any unique advice that you would give in regards to not just any business, but specifically businesses that are starting up and trying to deal with foreign trade?
Well, first of all, know your budget rates straight away. Know what your costs are, and know that if you cannot move prices within the business, then it's very important that you're actually protecting the business by locking in, if not all predicted currency in the future, certainly locking in a proportion of that foreign currency is very important to making sure that you're protecting the business from the downside risk of foreign exchange. Sure, there's always the opinion that, well, what if the market rebounds, and what if the Aussie sees a large increase in the future? But that's essentially the same way as almost gambling on that foreign currency. You're gambling that the market is gonna rebound and go higher, when the detrimental effect on the business is if the market does continue to fall, and the business can't factor in those costs or build that in, then foreign exchange is going to take a huge hit on the business's profitability.
You mentioned China earlier, and I want to use them as an example, because between the coronavirus pandemic and the US-China trade war that's ongoing at the moment, there's a lot more than just the foreign exchange that can affect us when we're dealing with foreign trade and foreign business. What strategies are smart companies employing to deal with this?
Well, smart companies at the minute, they look at the whole of China in that holistic view, and take into account, even if we look at the coronavirus, which has effectively shut down a number of factories for an extended period of time. Now, no one can predict that kind of event happening, but when it comes down to a few areas, one being foreign exchange and taking into account where the Aussie dollar is so sensitive to China, and obviously the RBA hasn't helped the Aussie dollar over the last 2 years by repeatedly cutting interest rates over that time period. I think we were at 1.5% interest for a record number of months there, over 32, I believe. So taking into account with China specifically and the way that I guess businesses look to constantly monitor, one, that foreign exchange risk, but then also when it comes down to building on trust with those suppliers, and that's where what we do here at Octet, by allowing Australian businesses to add their Chinese suppliers onto that secure network, that's something whereby they know that they have trusted suppliers which have been vetted by the business here, and they can manage that supply chain along the way with them, with various cash flow bridging sources as well.
That's wonderful. Seems to loop back to the start as well. It's all about trust in the end a bit, eh?
Exactly. That's it. That's the name of the game.
Joe Donaghy, Business Development Manager at Octet, speaking there with Ryan Stanton.
On the Money, get your shake of the sauce bottle.
Our working lives are changing with the advent of new technological integrations into industry, the increase of job casualisation, and recent market fluctuations caused by natural disasters. Many Australians are reconsidering their career options. So how do we start this process? Veronica Alashina spoke with Dr. Steve Endicott, financial advisor and founder of CIA Tax and author of The Man with a Plan, about the process of transitioning your side gig into a viable business.
I'm Dr. Steve, Dr. Steve Endicott. It's my second book. My first book was called Financial Distraction, and this one's followed 6 years later, which is The Man with a Plan. And it comes from 23 years of running an accounting practice. What I've seen over my career is the workforce is changing. You know, the average tenure for people now is about 3.3 years in a job. The OECD is predicting that about, you know, one-third, 34.6%, I think it is, of Australian jobs are going to disappear over the next decade with the effect of AI and automation replacing a lot of people. Yes, that will bring in new jobs for people to look after that aspect, but they will mainly go to the younger people. So I've really targeted, you know, this book specifically, I guess, for people who are Generation X, and I call them Generation X with an X on the back, because those people in their, you know, late 30s going into their 40s and 50s probably do face a fairly uncertain career pathway going forward. So it's a book that takes people through from, you know, starting up a side hustle, a side gig, and moving that in towards a small business and something that you might be able to quit your day job and go into full-time and grow your business from there up into a medium and beyond business. So it really is, it's a book of hope.
And it's, of course, you talk about the psychological aspect, and that's the most important thing to cover first up. But it's not just a motivational, you can do it kind of book. It takes you through the logistics and through the financial side and kind of the mindset that you need to be in, but also what you need to stay aware of. And I thought that was very interesting and quite unique, especially given the Australian context.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, you're absolutely spot on. You know, it's a how-to guide. It's, you know, how to actually start up a side hustle, how to grow that and get it all the way through. And the reason I write a lot of these things is a lot of people, from a psychological point of view, they actually hide from a decision out of fear. And they go, well, I don't understand this. So I can take away that fear or help them with that anxiety and say, well, actually, here's all you need to know. So commercialise your hobby is the key word I like to try to get across to people.
Absolutely. And you really emphasise this intersection of talents.
Yep.
This being kind of the major premise behind starting a side hustle or a side business. So can you talk a little bit to that concept?
Yeah, I can talk partially because a lot of people, you know, that they get caught up in a vanity. They're trying to be good or great at one thing. And I've got to look at people and go, well, forget it. You're not going to be great at one thing. There's always someone who's better than you or someone who's willing to undercut you in that industry. So trying to be successful at one thing I've found for most people is a vanity. You've got to look at more than one talent and combine them into unique success. The example I use throughout the book is Steve Jobs, great at nothing, but he was good at computers, he was good at design, he was driven by a purpose to change the world, and he did. We've all got multiple talents, and if we can put two of our multiple talents together that we like to do and look for a unique intersection of talent within there, I can guarantee you that's where you'll find not only your purpose, but you'll find your commercial success as well.
And you talk about purpose as being the major driving factor, directing your energy. So can you tell me a little bit about the importance of purpose or finding a purpose and kind of not conflating that with ideas of the meaning of life and big sort of philosophical concepts like that?
All right, well, I'll circle back to that in a second. You know, a lot of people say, I don't know what my purpose is. Well, I've got a procedure that actually, you know, starts to show you where your purpose is. But the real reason we need to be connected with our purpose is it's petrol. If you're doing something and your heart's not in it, you'll do it out of obligation, you'll do it because you need the money, you'll do it for, you know, negative motivations to a degree, But that will run out. Your enthusiasm for it will run out. When you're actually doing something that's in line with your passion and your purpose, I've found that the enthusiasm never runs out. Even myself, in my career, I've been 23 years at it. I have to force myself not to come into the office on Fridays now because I want to, but I know to preserve my career, you know, up into my 80s, because I don't ever want to retire, I've got to pace myself a little bit better. I actually love coming in and doing my job every single day. Yeah, I hope that sums it up with the enthusiasm there. But look, yeah. I find that people will come to me and say, but Stephen, I don't know what my purpose is. Well, in the book, I give a 3-step procedure. List your top 6 talents. So if you can sit down with friends, with mum, whoever it might be, and go, mum, dad, friends, myself, reflection, what am I actually good at? The second step is you reorder that list. You go, well, what do I like to do the most in that list? Because there's things we're good at, but we hate doing them. Well, the things we really love to do in that top 6 talents should be right at the top. And then if you start to look for an intersection of talent of 1 or 2 or 3, invariably you'll find purpose sitting in there.
Yeah, actually, I found myself doing these exercises that you provide throughout the book. And it was a very interesting sort of reflective moment for me, because I guess with the beginning of the year, you're focused on what it is that you want to achieve this year. This is a much longer term plan.
It is. And look, I do this every year. So I go away every single year on my own. I call it solitude with a pen and paper, try to avoid digital as much as possible, and fully debrief what's going on. You know, we are all carrying around an incredible amount of noise in our head. You know, that debriefing process of dumping everything in your head out onto a bit of paper where you can actually see what's in your head. And then if you start to reorder and reprioritise all the things that have come out, a lot of things aren't that important. You can just drop them off and really focus on the things that are purposeful or, you know, joyful in doing, and really say, well, I'm going to allocate my time to then. You know, purpose and success, I've found, is based on time management. The, the biggest word there is choice. We've all got time. A lot of people will say to me, well, I haven't got any time. Well, I'll go, give me 4% of your day. Well, that doesn't sound a lot. Well, that's an hour. So we can all find an hour to do something.
And so from the psychological to the more logistic side of things, the man with a plan tackles the growth of a business from side hustle all the way up to, well, essentially however far you want to take it.
Correct. Post-tax wealth, I call it.
Yeah, post-tax wealth. So can we talk a little bit about that journey? Is this something you've undertaken personally?
A lot of people will spend a lot of time coming up with complex business plans, signing up for many courses, investing in a lot of stock, in doing all sorts of things to avoid the actual issue. You ain't got nothing unless you got a sale. So I try to keep people who are starting up a business or starting up a side hustle, okay, a one-page business plan, let's get our first sale. So once you've got a sale, you've actually proved you've got a valid business idea.
Dr. Steve Endicott speaking with Veronica Alashina there. You're listening to On The Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers.
On The Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
Now, if you've got a small business, you might have a website, and this means that your business can be accessed by anybody who has access to the internet, which is most people these days. The problem is that just as there are criminals out on the streets who might want to physically break into your business, there are also criminals who want to break into your website and get access to your precious financial information. Cybersecurity criminals are not only attacking businesses, they are also attacking ordinary people with fake emails and other malware. Luis Ribera asked Ramesh Radhakrishna Giaro, a cybersecurity specialist, about current risks from using common technology.
What are some important things a business owner should know about securing their internet network?
So the internet security is really important for every single businesses around Australia or anywhere in the world. And the threats are for real at the moment. And as per the Gartner report, there are so much losses happening, and the losses are increasing every year in like millions of dollars. So in terms of cybersecurity, definitely our security is definitely, everyone should be aware of that, including the end user, not only the business owners or managers. Every individual, whoever access the computer connecting to the internet, they should be aware of the threats.
Who are the most vulnerable when it comes to getting attacked by cyber criminals?
Yeah, pretty much everyone. The attack is immense, and probably it affects every single person. Like in the businesses, like in my accountant also got skimmed about $18,000 lately because his network was vulnerable and someone trying to transfer money from his account to somebody else's account, which is the banks looking and look after that. As a part of the security of his own computer, he is responsible for that. That means you need to get a proper antivirus solutions for his computer and making sure everything is in place. When you are handling other people's data, that you are liable for securing their contents as well.
Why are people so curious to click maybe a spam email?
Yeah.
Do you know what's the reason behind the psychology?
Because the psychology here is some of the email that comes here, as if it's like your infringement notice or someone trying to repay your money back to your PayPal or something like that. So people think, oh, the money's coming back, let's see what's that. So which one is returning my money? Or your traffic infringement, which light I jumped. So they wanted to know, instantly wanted to know what they have done. So that triggers them to click that email. And that's good enough to cause the damage. That's when the damage is already done. So they use this kind of phrases like which people react immediately. They use those kind of emails. So that means without thinking, they click. So that's good enough. And as a ransomware is one of the things that happened in my business, one of the customer's business, that's what happened. Though I protect everything using a proper firewall and all that, but one of the user clicked the particular email, and which encrypted the whole systems in the network.
So how would you use an analogy of cybersecurity to the physical world?
Cybersecurity, the threat you don't see. Okay, the way that only you are going to be affected because you are connected to the internet. That means your physical property, your physical, it's a peace of mind. If you're not connected to the internet, everything is good. If you're connected to the internet, that means you are already.
So it's not like you're actually visualizing somebody stealing your phone or stealing something from your house. You can actually see that, right?
Yeah.
But if somebody steals something from the internet or from your internet devices, you won't see it.
You don't see them, yes, because they get access to your belongings, like your personal data, like your mobile contacts and your data on your computers, like pictures and all that.
Bank account details.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. So also the saving passwords on the browser, that's a bad habit. So if someone gets hold of your computer, then they know the password for free.
So you suggest that people should manually enter their...
Remember your passwords.
Password every time.
Apps there are... Write down your passwords in your phone with a password protected notepad or something.
As we've heard, the internet can be dangerous, especially if you have a business and have sensitive emails containing information about quotes or prices from vendors. As we've heard, it's a dangerous place for all users because they could be hacked and lose their cherished photos or other information or become victims of engineered scams by con artists. The industry of cybersecurity is an emerging market with high earning potentials, as there is a big demand for internet security. I asked an IT student from TAFE at St. Leonard's, why is he interested in studying cybersecurity?
I'm mainly looking at networking and network security, cybersecurity, that sort of area.
And why are you interested in that type of the IT area?
It's definitely like a growth industry. So there's a lot of jobs available, and it's just interesting. It's quite complex, like some parts, but not too difficult.
And do you see yourself working in that industry in 5 years?
Yeah, I think so, definitely.
What sort of role would you be interested in?
I think maybe in 5 years I'd probably be maybe running some sort of team, or maybe even looking at starting my own business.
What should one consider if they're looking to learning or taking up a course on cybersecurity or network security?
Well, from a lot of people that I've spoken to, they definitely recommend experience over like doing like a degree. So they say that especially in most of the IT industry, even companies look more for experience. So if you start off in like a low down role and work up, they see that as preferable to say having a degree.
Max Puddicum, a cybersecurity student, ending that report by Luis Ribera. And that's all we have time for on The Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Thanks to our producers, Luis Ribera, Veronica Alashina and Ryan Stanton. On The Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. Our Twitter handle is at OnTheMoney2SER. I'm Roderick Chambers. We're going to be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.